Hello, and you are listening to the Donbas Devushka podcast. I am joined by Donbas Devushka herself and our guest, Mr. David Swanson. Mr. Swanson is an author and anti-war activist who has dealt with a number of myths that exist out in the Western public space, and especially ones which are used to justify war and the particular form that militarism takes in Western societies, particularly the United States. One of his focuses is on myths about the Western allies, and in particular the United States, in World War II. And that's a lot of actually what, along with the current conflict in Ukraine, we will be discussing today. Hello, everyone.
Hi, thank you for coming.
Hi, great to be here.
So my first question is then, you wrote your book, Leaving World War II Behind, but it actually stemmed from several lectures you gave on justifications for military budgets and how World War II was just used as a Trump card. And that you say in the book that every time you give a brief lecture on some myths about World War II, you've changed quite a few minds. Can you explain to us how you came to end up writing this lecture and the book, and what sort of events shaped how you framed the argument that is contained within?
Absolutely. And it's not several, it's hundreds of times that I've spoken to groups of people, classrooms, people at peace events or online events, and spoken about ending war, and especially in the United States, but in some other Western countries as well. You talk about abolishing war, you ask whether there can be such a thing as a good war, a justifiable war, a war that should have been fought, and over 99% of the time, you're going to hear about World War II. I mean, it's that dominant in the argument. I think I probably recount in the book that I do a magic trick where I write down World War II, and then I ask someone to think of a war that's ever been justifiable. And then I show them that I had written down what I magically put into their mind, because it's that predictable. And it's equally predictable that if I say, why is it World War II out of the thousands of wars? Could you not think of a war of the past 75 years, perhaps, during which we've dumped, trillions and trillions of dollars and killed millions and millions of people? Can you not think of one of those that's justifiable? And it's just as predictable. Over 90% of the time, someone will say Hitler, Nazis, Holocaust, evil of Germany, and almost not never will the Pacific or Japan be mentioned in any way. And if you start to talk to them about the actual history, if you ask them to watch the new Ken Burns movie, never thought I'd recommend one of those in my life, about the actual reality that the United States government did nothing to help millions of people who wanted to get out of Germany, and who for years Germany wanted to kick out of Germany, that in fact the war impeded efforts to aid those people rather than aiding them. And the war itself, of course, killed several times the number of people killed in those horrible camps and so forth. Then they really start to have doubts and open their minds to further conversations about all kinds of aspects about World War II.
Yes, indeed. However, could you talk us through our viewers about maybe just a few points about why it is that World War II, in your opinion, is not such this justified war that we often get, where, as you have pointed out, all you need to do in order to trump some argument is often just say World War II without without even needing to expand on what you mean when you, someone just says World War II to provide Hitler to provide a justification for why we must do this or that.
Right. Well, I mean, I can touch on a few points. It's a whole book, right? But I think if it were just a historical question, if it didn't have any impact on today, I really wouldn't care what people thought about World War II. You know, I don't care if people love the U.S. Civil War, as long as if they want to get rid of mass incarceration, they just jump straight to the legislation and don't, you know, kill millions of young people in some fields first and then pass a bill to end mass incarceration. Like, we've moved beyond this sort of thinking, except when it comes to World War II, people imagine that it's somehow relevant. And, you know, the bulk of the book and most of the points that I try to make are related to what really happened at that time. But I think an important additional point is that we live in a very different world with a very different system of international law, of international relations, a revolutionized understanding of the power of nonviolent action as a superior alternative to military defense, a world with nuclear weapons in it, a world with dire crises, existential crises that cannot be addressed without getting beyond the impediment of war. And so forth. So, you know, Hitler is not coming to get you. Putin is not Hitler. You know, this is an important point. But assuming we want to go back and justify World War II, I mean, it didn't have to happen. Its chief architects, people like Winston Churchill, you know, openly admitted it didn't have to happen. And the absurd thing is that it's hard to find a historian who won't say World War I didn't have to happen. World War I could have been easily avoided. People like Winston Churchill maneuvered very carefully to get into World War I. It's very hard to find a historian who won't say that World War II was a sequel, that World War II was an extension of World War I, that there were smart people predicting World War II almost down to the minute upon the conclusion of World War I with the horrible Treaty of Versailles. And yet you have this widespread contention that, you know, World War II simply had to happen. Well, okay, let's say it didn't have to happen, but in the moment when it's already started, what do? You have to join it. Well, do you have to join it? Were there not alternatives? Did you have to expand it and escalate it and normalize what we now, you know, accept as routine, but were considered unacceptable barbaric practices at the time, such as bombing civilians, bombing cities? You know, this is, World War II was the single worst thing that humanity has done to itself in any short span of time in terms of immediate deaths, injuries, destruction, environmental damage, damage to the rule of law, and the precedents it set, and the shapes of military industrial complexes and empires that it fostered. And so, you know, you go back and you look at the mythology where the U.S. all good and angelic and Germany the devil, and you say, but Germany learned so much from the U.S. Hitler was emulating U.S. policy toward Native Americans. The Germans, the Nazis came over and studied U.S. segregation laws to develop their laws for Jews and other people they abused in Germany. They learned from and deeply appreciated the U.S. so-called science of eugenics. They developed very similar ideas to those that were developing in the U.S. and Italy and France and elsewhere. The fascistic tendencies were not exclusive to Germany. And of course, the United States welcomed Nazis into the U.S. military upon the conclusion of the war and began developing plans for dropping hundreds of nuclear weapons on the Soviet Union before the Soviet Union could get nuclear weapons. Didn't work out because they did get them, that far outstripped the horrendous plans that the Nazis had had for Eastern Europe. So, you know, it's not a picture of good versus evil. It's a picture of evil across the board, which is what war making is.
That is a very good overview. Now, however, of course, having set out the case, I'm going to be challenging with some counterpoints. And of course, welcome your response. So the first point you raised there, which is that the Treaty of Versailles baked in structurally, almost, it seems, in the international system, the idea that World War One would happen and that it was a very awful treaty. A few points. First, France itself had in the 19th century twice been defeated in war and twice had a similar peace imposed on it, including with territorial loss and massive reparations. France, in all occasions, accepted the territorial losses, albeit very grudgingly, and paid the reparations, albeit very grudgingly, but they then didn't start a general European war to recover their territory. So why then should the Treaty of Versailles have baked this into the equation of the European balance of politics that Germany was going to try and rearm and go to war again when France had not?
Well, it wasn't guaranteed because we don't have crystal balls and we can't predict the future for certain. But there were many people who predicted it, who turned out to be right. And I think in part, it's a question of degree, a question of the severity of the damage to the German economy, the suffering. In part, it's a question of how it was exacerbated after the treaty, including with the British blockade of Germany, aimed at starving people to death, denounced as inhumane by President Hoover and so forth. And in part, a question of how the world was being globalized, how international relations were changing, and international structures were being developed, and the League of Nations was being created, but Germany was being left out of it. This was a Germany that desperately wanted global power, and not only wasn't getting it, but was being shunted aside and left out of the international community. Did that morally justify Germany starting another war? Of course not. Did some people predict that it would lead to Germany starting another war? And were they right? Yes. Was I one of them? No, I wasn't around. But you could see it coming. And the Western powers that to some degree could see it coming and nonetheless went on supporting the fascists in Italy and Spain and the Nazis in Germany as preferable to communism, as preferable to the Soviets, the U.S. corporations whose support right through the war, top Nazis said was absolutely essential, couldn't have had the war without them. These were people who ought to have known better.
And certainly, I think that is a very good point, which is that certainly a tension had been baked into the system with Versailles. And certainly, as you point out in the book, the United States itself and also governments, particularly in the United Kingdom, but also in France, supported forces in Germany and in Italy that made it a lot likelier that this structural tension would lead to war by not trying to do what they could for other forces, as you said, in particular, simply because they viewed these forces as preferable to communism. but that nonetheless, the British blockade continued in Germany as a means of getting it to sign Versailles. After Versailles, the blockade was lifted, and unlike other countries in Europe, Germany had not been invaded. It had not been overrun by hostile armies and had much of its industry destroyed, but that had happened to France. So, once again, since it had been Germany doing the invasion and Germany that gave Austria-Hungary the blank check and Germany that was territorially intact with its industry, in that sense, why shouldn't they have paid? And given that others in situations that they found themselves in had paid and then stayed more or less peaceful, why should the Germans then have been particularly resentful, especially when some of the weaknesses in the international system that you mentioned were mediated because the sanctions payments were cut back and delayed often, and later Germany was invited into the League of Nations. As a matter of fact, by the end of the 1920s, it was essentially being treated as a great power again that could rearm at the drop of the hat. So this is something that I'm trying to understand here about why then, you know, Versailles was so uniquely awful, simply because it doesn't seem to me as though it was.
I don't think it was uniquely awful in that all other settlements of wars and treaties among nations have been good and just and fair and predictably beneficial. I think it was particularly awful in that it helped lead to the very worst thing that's ever happened, and in the dramatic contrast between what it was and what Wilson had promised. Wilson was the Barack Obama of his day. He was, you know, dreamed of as, you know, entirely different from who he actually was. And he promised a peace without victor and loser. He promised reconciliation and an end to hostilities. He didn't deliver anything like that in Versailles, and the French and the British, who were intent on vengeance against Germany, got it. Was that justified by some sort of poetic justice because of the evils Germany had done? I mean, at some point, you have to start distinguishing between governments and people. You have to recognize that this was also the age of establishing with the Geneva Conventions that collective punishment was a crime. And so if we start talking about the justifiability of collectively punishing a whole population because of the evils done through their government and their tax dollars and their military with their tolerance of it, you know, Should the U.S. public be punished for the evils of the wars of the past several decades, the evils of the wars in places like Iraq and Vietnam? Of course not. But should the U.S. public know about and regret and express remorse and apologize and try to compensate? Of course. And, you know, I think you make an excellent point in that Germany hadn't suffered the level of destruction of even some other places, just as even in World War II, the United States didn't suffer the destruction and was much more willing. The U.S. public has been, for the past 75 years, much more willing than the places that were destroyed to engage in new wars. And this is something that the German public, to its everlasting shame, was to a great extent willing to go along with in starting a sequel, in starting the Second World War. We're gonna go along with setting up another war. But to their everlasting credit, post-World War II in Germany, German kids are taught the evils committed in the past by the German nation. Doesn't mean they all learn it very well. Doesn't mean there aren't hate groups in Germany. But in comparison to the United States, where in Washington, D.C., there, you know, are monuments glorifying every war the U.S. has been in. There are monuments demonizing the crimes of Germany. But there's nothing about the victims of U.S. wars anywhere to be seen. And you try to ask a U.S. kid or even a U.S. adult, even within a couple orders of magnitude, how many people has the U.S. killed in recent wars? They can't begin to tell you. You can ask a German today about the horrors of the Second World War, and they can give you an education.
Yes. And also you say that it didn't have to happen, but then in order for it to have not happened, it would have required some military preemption, given Nazi ideological drives, which were quite baked into the equation, I think, with the Nazis. I think that's also safe to say, simply because once Gregor Strasser had been removed from the leadership, there could be no possibility of any kind of flexibility on this point. I think, as academics like Adam Tooze have shown, and among many others, this drive to war was pretty baked in. So to have done otherwise would have required a lot more peremptory action, and that action would have been military, such as a military response from France and Britain upon the remilitarization of the Rhineland. Or am I missing something here, perhaps?
Well, I think you're missing a huge something, and that's, I mean, there are many other things as well we could talk about, but the huge something I want to talk about for most is the incredible success rate of nonviolent action in preventing wars, in overthrowing oppressive governments, in preventing military coups. If you look at worldbeyondwar.org/list, you see a developing list of dozens and dozens of successful uses of nonviolent action in situations where everybody and their brother will tell you the choices were war or nothing. In fact, studies have, of course, been done in recent years comparing over the past century or more nonviolent campaigns and violent campaigns, and finding nonviolence to be over twice as likely to succeed, and those successes far longer lasting than violent. And so this notion that you can get into a situation where your only choice is war. You know, the one problem with this is the insistence on dialing your time machine back to the very last moment. You know, why not go back a month earlier, a year earlier, a decade earlier, as long as we're traveling through time? But with everyone's love for that moment, nonetheless, nonviolent action can be used. And of course, it can be used better when you've prepared for it, when instead of merely investing endless national treasure and time and energy and personnel into preparing for war, you've done the same with nonviolence. There are nations, in fact, including some of the Baltic states, worried about Soviet and now Russian invasion, that have developed unarmed civil resistance plans and forces, if that's the word for it. So because the notion, and this is precisely why World War II is still going to kill us all, and I don't just mean by the bombs still going off in Germany, it is this idea that there can be certain particular militaries or countries or evil dictators who simply require war and nothing else will do, even though resorting to the most powerful tool means resorting to nonviolent activism. This is the idea that drives military spending. You can live through 80 years of wars that nobody wants to talk about a single one of them, and still have this dream in mind that next week there could be a war where nothing else would do. You had to have war. And so we need to, we absolutely must impoverish half the people in our country, neglect the dying environment of planet Earth, defund everything else in order to prepare for that possible unavoidable war. And of course, that preparation generates war after war after war.
We'll come back to whether or not military budgets actually prevent us from doing some of these things. But I also wanted to instead go back to one of the other points that you raised, and I think that you set out as a very nice overview primer, which is the role of big business, especially American big business, in helping sustain the Nazi peacetime economy and then the Nazi wartime economy, even after the United States had declared war on Germany and the United States government had said, right, you have to end all business with your German subsidiaries. From, you know, all throughout various corporate offices in America, people scream bloody murder. Could you walk us through that, a bit of that sordid history?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's hard for people who've grown up on millions of hours of saturation infotainment of the U.S. versus the Nazis to remember the support that there was in the U.S. And other Western nations for Nazis and Nazi-like efforts. The number of coup attempts that were plotted against Franklin Roosevelt to bring about a Nazi government in the United States, and the extent to which the super wealthy, the powerful corporate owners in the United States were disproportionately sympathetic to fascism. So it's useful to go back and look, as I do in the book, at the research that various people have done in the years since at the support of companies like IBM that worked for the Nazis, that worked on the machinery for the concentration camps with absolutely no moral qualms. The companies like Ford that were looking out for their bottom line, as is the moral requirement for a good corporation, but we're also really sympathetic at the top level. You know, Henry Ford was a believer in fascism, was perhaps Adolf Hitler's favorite author. And when U.S. troops arrived in Germany in World War II, they were sometimes surprised to see Germans with U.S.-made vehicles. And these were vehicles supplied throughout the course of the war in Germany, using German forced labor. DuPont, of course, huge supporter of fascistic groups in the United States and of Nazi Germany, General Motors, and not just the corporations, but the banks and the financial institutions that were so supportive of Nazi Germany. And again, you had top Nazis claiming that without the supplies, the raw materials, as well as the industry supplied by U.S. corporations, They couldn't have sustained the war. They couldn't have planned the major war that they did and engaged in it. And it's, you know, it's a topic that nobody wants to talk about. I'm hoping that someday it gets more attention. We've just seen Rachel Maddow, of all people, do a series on the supporters of Nazi Germany within the U.S. government, including in the U.S. Congress. We've again just seen a Ken Burns movie on the failure of the U.S. To support refugees who needed rescue from Germany. And I think the reason we're seeing these things, and we're seeing the New York Times question U.S. monuments to people like Wernher von Braun, who was a U.S. scientist after he was a Nazi scientist, is because they're all being explicitly framed as anti-Trumpian, not as anti-American. And if this lasts a little while, that it can be anti-Trumpian and therefore acceptable in slightly left corporate media to talk about the history of fascism and support for Nazism in the United States, maybe we will get more investigation and more attention brought to this story, despite its running counter to the primary foundational myth of the U.S. government.
But then perhaps is the problem not just the myth of World War II and like how are we are taught, because this has been known about, all these sorts of details have been known about for quite some time. They were known clearly by the U.S. government during the war, and researchers not long after the war were talking about this. Operation Paperclip, albeit its name was not known, the fact that Nazi scientists were being lifted by Western intelligence and being kept safe was known all the way back in the 50s and early 60s, and also talked about in exposés. And so people, at least who had lived through World War II, were quite aware of some of the hypocrisy. And I was also thinking about, as you pointed out, with some of the Nazi social practices, that there was the award-winning film Judgment at Nuremberg, which is based off of the judges' trials. And in it, the movie does discuss at quite some length how some of the inspiration that the Nazis got for some of their laws do come from the United States. So there was, I think, quite closer to World War II, at least it seems from what you can track from media, more of a popular awareness of, there isn't quite as much difference there between us, the good Americans, and them, the very evil Nazis, as we would quite like to believe, and we shouldn't be too comfortable about that. Am I missing something here, or has it just gotten worse as memories have faded?
Well, I think that last point is a key one, and it's not just that memories fade, it's that memories are actively erased. I mean, when something is a top news story, when it's discussed for weeks in all the leading newspapers and media outlets of the day, and then later nobody has ever heard of it. You know, take, for example, the conference in Evian, France, where the nations of the world decide not to help any of the Jews in Germany. This wasn't secret. You know, this wasn't undercover spy operations dug out with Freedom of Information Act requests. You know, this is just something that happened that was big news. And now nobody's ever heard of it. It's been eliminated. It's been erased. You know, I was just writing a more recent book about the Monroe Doctrine and looking at people like filibusterer who went, William Walker, who went and made himself president of Nicaragua. And nobody in the United States has ever heard of the guy, but nobody in Central America has not heard of the guy. And it's a choice made by educational systems and infotainment systems. And so I think in addition, it's important to remember that at the time of World War II, although it maintained public support for longer than most wars in larger numbers, although it was, especially the U.S. part, it was much shorter than any recent wars, it was not seen as this glorious contest between good and evil. It was understood as horrific. The biggest celebrations were when it ended. And it wasn't until the Vietnam War era that it really began to be called the Good War and treated as this exceptional model, justifiable moral war. And I think the motivation for that was largely the disgust with the war in Vietnam and the fear among those in power that this would become a disgust with war in general. Right. And this aversion to war was labeled a disease. It was called the Vietnam syndrome. We saw the same thing with the war in Iraq. If you were going to oppose it, you had to support the war in Afghanistan and start calling it a good war. Nobody had called it a good war, and nobody ever would have without the war on Iraq. Right. And so I think at the time of World War II, you would never would have had what you had recently. I recounted in the book a Miss World or Miss Italy, a contest winner in Italy, asked in the competition, you know, what era of the past would you like to go back to? And she immediately says World War II. And then the whole Italian media system mocks her as an imbecile. What do you want to get bombed, locked up? What are you talking about? But how could she have possibly said anything else? Growing up in Western culture with Western movies, who wouldn't want to live in the one time where everything was clear cut and we were the good guys and the other guys were the evil guys and war was glorious? Who wouldn't want to go back to that? Well, people who lived through it, that's who.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, that probably what inspired her in that instance to say that was a lot more media than education, because certainly, at least from what I know, in Italy, they are taught that, you know, that was a very awful time to be alive, because Italy just was raked over from one end to the other between 1942 and 1945, just by way of example, in one country. And as we know, compared to the Soviet Union, Italy got off very, very lightly. So I think these are then good points. And rather than continue to dwell too much on World War II, I was thinking that we would expand the conversation. So, as you've pointed out, we can have a warfare or we can have the things that we need. Here is where I would push back on that a bit, which is that we did, during the Cold War era, lots of infrastructure investments in the United States, and we expanded the welfare state. The Great Society, after all, was inaugurated during the Vietnam War. Medicare was inaugurated during the Vietnam War. And military spending at that time was 7 to 8% of GDP, and now it's just under 4% of GDP, and yet there seem to be no infrastructure investments, and welfare is constantly being cut back, but the military has not stayed constant as a share of the economy. So then, is the problem really warfare here, or a lack of political will to fund other things?
I think it's an excellent point. When the banks need billions of dollars because they cheated and lied and are running out of money, money is simply invented out of thin air for them. When there is a disease pandemic and something needs critical funding, billions of dollars can be made to appear out of nowhere. And so as long as money can be generated, why couldn't we generate it for human needs, for environmental needs? Why must a country with the single most expensive institution ever devised, the U.S. military, have so much poverty and suffering and insecurity and destitution? Why must the world, for that matter, when we're talking about levels of spending that could transform the world, not just this little corner of it? You know, it certainly would be fine with me. The purpose, the reason that we put up billboards saying 3% of U.S. military spending could end starvation on Earth, it's not because that's the only place that that money could come from. It's to make the contrast. It's to explain to people that there is money, that money can exist, that money is being wasted, in fact, misspent on something destructive rather than spent on something constructive. Because otherwise, when you propose, you know, in the U.S. media in general, when you propose to make college free, or to have trains that aren't 3 days late, there's just an endless predictable chorus of, but where are you going to get the money? But where are you going to get the money? But where are you going to get the money? And of course, you could get it from reasonable taxation of billionaires and multimillionaires or of corporations. You could get it through a wealth tax. You could get it through a tax on financial transactions. You could get it any number of ways. But one way you could get it would be to take back just a little bit of military spending, which if you wanted it just to go back to where it was in the year 2000, you cut it almost in half. If you wanted to go back to the glorious day of conservative righteousness of 1950, you have to cut over three quarters of it. And that could be done, and we'd be better off. We'd be better off not only because we'd be putting the money into places where it's really needed, but because the military spending is going to kill us all, is the reason for the nuclear risk that is arguably higher than it's ever been, is a major reason, a major contributor to the environmental collapse we're seeing, as well as impediment to cooperation on the environmental and other crises, as well as the justification for government secrecy, impediment to self-governance, fueler of racism and bigotry and hatred, you know, instigator of violence and corrosion of our culture domestically as well as abroad. I mean, we would be better off in so many ways if we moved money out of militarism into something good. But it would be doing two good things at once. And if you wanted to fund something good by some other means, absolutely, I'm all for it.
Can we start drawing some parallels to what's going on right now? How does the United States, well, the United States easily manufactured consent for World War II. I mean, that's not a question. It did pretty well with Vietnam until the troops started coming back. Their ability to manufacture consent with this conflict has not been that great. Would you agree with that?
I don't know. I mean, it remains to be seen, right? The polling is predictably changing. Support is dying off, as it always does, a year and a half into a war in my lifetime, with wars like Afghanistan and Iraq and the other wars we've seen in the recent decades. You've seen close to a majority or even over a majority in support at the start, and within a year, year and a half, strong majorities that never go back, saying not only end it, and in fact, not always saying end it, but saying it never should have been started. And with Ukraine, you are not seeing a single U.S. casket. Needless to say, 96% of humanity really doesn't matter. It's that 4% that counts. And it's not called a U.S. war. And most people think, as we were just talking about, that money is pretty magical, limitless stuff, you know, get it from somewhere else if we need it for something else. Nonetheless, you are seeing, not just for partisan reasons, but to some extent across the board, you are seeing people start to say, no, we don't support this. And, you know, you still have, I think, a majority in a lot of polls willing to go on supporting it. And I don't think to any significant extent people have caught on to the duplicitous role the U.S. government has been playing in working against ending the war, in working against negotiations while sending endless weaponry and blaming Ukraine and saying Ukraine won't let us negotiate an end to the war. But when I look back at 12 months ago, there was, you know, there was a day, whatever day it was in February of last year, when I could walk down the street and ask people what Ukraine was, and they couldn't tell me it was a country. And within a matter of hours, random people wanted to talk about this with strangers, thought it was their moral duty to talk about the need to arm Ukraine and support Ukraine. Ukrainian flags started showing up on houses of people who the week before couldn't find Ukraine on a map. That's impressive to me. That's it. And we were just talking about, I mean, in U.S. entertainment, the image of a German tank is pretty much the image of evil. It's now a moral necessity to get German tanks rolling into a war. That's impressive. The skill, the propaganda accomplishments to do that sort of thing is scary to my mind.
Do you think that this conflict now involves remnants of grudges left over from World War II? I mean, we could argue that people feel a morality, not because of Ukraine, but mostly because of being anti-Russia and evil Putin and Russiagate and interfering with elections and all of those crazy stories. And also this kind of like leaving Germany kind of out in the lurch. And I mean, we can all probably agree that out of the EU nations that Germany has taken the biggest hits economically. And now that we've seen them kind of be bullied into dipping into their armory and giving it to Ukraine. So how much of these current goings on and these sentiments have to do with things that are kind of left over and hangovers from World War II?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's always been, not always, but in recent decades, it's been incredible the percentage you could get in polling of people in the United States who didn't know which side of World War II the Soviet Union was on. Right. When during World War II, you had people putting bumper stickers on their cars in the United States and driving 35 miles per hour to save rubber, saying, open a Western front, support the heroic Soviets who are fighting the Nazis, join and help them. You know, they were heroes. Right. And now, you don't have to look far for somebody who will tell you that the United States won World War II against the evil Russians, right? And I think one reason is that for 75 years, every time there's been war propaganda, the enemy has been usually explicitly identified with Hitler. You know, there's a new Hitler everywhere. And Vladimir Putin is the latest Hitler. It doesn't matter that he's from a country, from the country that principally defeated Hitler. You know, Russia was just left out of the ceremony at the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, even though it was Russia that liberated the darn place, because Russia is now Germany. Putin is now Hitler. And so the framework has been put in place where people understand that there can be an evil, aggressive, imperial nation, as long as it's not this one, and it needs to be defeated with, you know, to the last life. And it can be transferred. It can be imposed on Iraq or Syria or Libya or Russia. I mean, I think that's the legacy of the U.S. understanding of World War II.
Very, very powerfully argued. And I think that leaves our listeners with something to think about. David, thank you. Unless there are any other...
I want David to tell us about the upcoming Rage Against the War Machine. Did I get that right? That kind of rally that's happening in USA, and I think it's in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, there's a website, rageagainstwar.com, that is for planning a rally and march in Washington, D.C. on February 19th. And there are at least three or four, maybe more, rallies happening in other parts of the United States on that same day, the United States really being too big for people to get to the Capitol for a march, with rare exceptions. And it's encouraging because there's been so little anti-war activism, because you have two big political parties and they both support the war, and most people are loyal to one or the other of these parties, most people who get active in any way. And so when you should have more anti-war activism, you have less. But here is a group of outsiders, including some people I disagree with passionately on many things, who are willing to get together and say, we agree on opposing this war, and we need to get in the streets. You know, and frankly, I think we ought to be ashamed to see the giant anti-war rallies in places like Italy when they're not happening in the heart of the military institution, which is Washington, D.C. So I'm hoping that this will be a good one, and that people can get there if they're able and support it, and do likewise in other parts of the world.
Thank you for that. We were actually just talking about the guest list before you popped into the room, and listeners, this is the lineup is pretty incredible. Just some really amazing names. A lot of people that have been guests or are going to be guests on the show. So highly recommend that you check it out. If you are in the position to, maybe donate to it. These kinds of movements are important, and they are grassroots, and they rely on grassroots donations. Also, what brought us all together today, Mr. Swanson's wonderful book, Leaving World War II Behind. Highly, highly recommended. We'll put a link into the description. And David, I think they can find you on antiwar.com. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Once in a while, at least, they'll publish something of mine, and I very much appreciate that. And I'm at davidswanson.org, and I work at worldbeyondwar.org and rootsaction.org and lots of other places.
And we will link them all in the description. Thank you so much, David. This has been a lovely time.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.